Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are tearing into a really fascinating stack of sources today. It's focused on a pretty overlooked area of public health, the intersection of lifestyle and chronic pain. And you've brought in research that tries to move beyond just, you know, telling individuals what to do.
That's absolutely right. The idea here is to quantify the massive potential impact of population-level policy shifts.
Okay.
Our mission is concrete. We're trying to put a number on what happens if an entire population makes these, you know, modest, achievable improvements in two key things.
Physical activity and BMI.
Physical activity and body mass index, or BMI. And then see how that would reduce the burden of what's called high-impact chronic pain, or HICP.
So you want the numbers to really back up the argument for these big structural public health investments?
Exactly.
Okay, so before we get to those numbers, we should probably understand the scale of the problem. We're not just talking about a mild ache here.
No, not at all.
Chronic pain is. It's distressingly common. The global estimate is somewhere around 31%. But it's this HICP that really cripples health systems, right?
Yeah.
And just tanks quality of life.
HICP is the critical factor. It's the kind of pain that's severe enough to cause significant limitations in, well, in daily activities and work, in your social life.
And the sources, they use the UK Biobank data set, right?
Yes, a massive data set, over 166,000 participants. And they use a very specific objective proxy to define what HICP actually is.
So walk us through that. What was the proxy definition?
Yeah.
It was chronic pain plus something else.
Right. It's chronic pain plus a reduced health-related quality of life score, specifically an EQ5D index score below 0.81.
So what is that number, that 0.81 threshold, what does that actually signify for a layperson?
Well, the EQ5D, it's a standardized measure. It looks at five dimensions of health: mobility, self-care, usual activities, pain or discomfort, and anxiety or depression. So that 0.81 threshold isn't arbitrary. It's a functional cutoff that researchers use that signals a really meaningful adverse decline in overall quality of life.
So below that number, people are reporting significant measurable difficulty in those areas. Their pain has gone from just being there to being genuinely debilitating.
Exactly. It's become high impact.
Okay, let's unpack this. Why are we looking at population shifts in health behaviors? I mean, why not just focus all the policy effort on improving individual clinical management? That feels like what we always hear.
It's really an epidemiological necessity. The prevalence of chronic pain is just. It's too high for individual clinical approaches like physical therapy or drugs to solve the problem at a public health level.
There are just too many people.
Too many people. If you want to move the needle on a condition that affects a third of the population, you have to address the risk factors across the entire community.
And this brings us straight to the foundational philosophy of Jeffrey Rose.
The Rose Principle.
Exactly.
Rose was the one who argued that if you focus all your resources only on the highest risk individuals,
the people with the most extreme obesity, the most sedentary lifestyles.
Right. You'll actually have a limited effect on the overall disease prevalence. Because most cases of the disease, they come from the huge number of people who are just at a moderate but very common risk.
So the idea is that a small, achievable shift in risk across the entire population gives you a better public health return on investment.
A much better return.
You might not turn everyone into a marathon runner, but you get everyone to, say, take an extra 1,000 steps a day.
Precisely. And this study used a pretty sophisticated modeling method called parametric G computation to test that very principle.
G computation. Okay, that sounds extremely technical.
It is.
Can you give us an analogy for how this method lets them estimate these what-if scenarios?
Yeah, of course. I guess you could think of it like statistical time travel. Or maybe a massive digital simulation.
Okay.
Observational data tells us what did happen in that UK biobank population.
Right.
G computation is a technique that lets researchers create a sort of a counterfactual world. They say, what if for every single person in this 166,000 person data set, their body mass index had been 7% lower?
Ah. So they're basically rerunning the tape of the population's life, but with one key variable just subtly adjusted across the entire group.
Exactly. And that lets them estimate the potential impact of a structural public health policy instead of just saying people who are fit have less pain, which, I mean, we already know that.
Let's start with physical activity then, PA, The shifts they modeled were realistic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Achievable goals for the population, not some fixed, impossible target.
Correct. They found that, you know, generalized, modest increases in activities like walking, they yielded some benefit, but the effects were pretty small.
So where was the real impact?
The real quantitative reduction in HICP came from targeting more intense exercise.
Tell us about the two most successful scenarios they modeled for PA.
Okay, so the baseline HICP prevalence for this population was 18.1%. The single most impactful scenario was targeting vigorous physical activity. They asked, what if the population increased it by 2 additional days per week and 20 extra minutes per session?
That's a pretty aggressive shift.
It is, but it's potentially achievable. And that shift reduced HICP prevalence to 17.6% in the fully adjusted model.
Okay, that's a 0.5 percentage point reduction. Which doesn't sound massive, but we have to remember the Rose principle. You apply that to a population of 60 million people. That's hundreds of thousands fewer people in debilitating pain.
It's huge. And the second high-impact scenario was a combined effort. Increasing all activity types, light, moderate, and vigorous, by 1 extra day per week and 10 minutes per session.
So a little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything. And that one reduced prevalence from 18.1% down to 17.4% in the fully adjusted model.
You keep stressing fully adjusted model. Why is that adjustment so important? What are they adjusting for?
This is a really key statistical point. If you just look at the unadjusted model.
So just physical activity versus HICP.
Right. In that model, the vigorous PA scenario showed a much larger benefit. It dropped prevalence all the way down to 15.8%.
Wow, that's a massive difference. So why does the benefit shrink so much in the final analysis?
Because the fully adjusted model statistically strips out the effect of all these other pre-existing health conditions and factors that are tangled up with both pain and physical activity.
Like what?
Age, sex, deprivation, smoking, and critically existing comorbidities, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancers.
I see. So the unadjusted result says activity is good, but the fully adjusted result tells us that even after we account for the fact that active people are just healthier in general,
mm-hmm.
physical activity still offers an independent, measurable benefit against HICP. The smaller adjusted reduction is the more reliable direct effect.
Precisely. It's the cleaner number. It acknowledges the complexity of all this.
Wait, so if the PA benefits are real but, you know, relatively modest in that adjusted model, here's where it gets really interesting. Let's talk about BMI. Did weight reduction show a more robust effect?
It really did. And the feasibility of modeling a population-wide BMI reduction, it's actually supported by history.
Mm.
In the UK, the mean BMI went up by 8% between 1985 and 2005.
So they just wanted to see what happens if you reverse that trend.
Exactly.
What was the baseline prevalence for the BMI model population?
It was 18.9%. And the major scenario they modeled was a 7% reduction in BMI across the entire population distribution.
And the outcome?
That 7% reduction in BMI was associated with a decrease in HICP prevalence from 18.9% down to 17.5%, again, in the fully adjusted model.
Okay, wait. That's a 1.4 percentage point reduction.
Yeah.
That is significantly larger than what the highest physical activity intervention showed.
Yeah.
So a weight intervention had a bigger adjusted effect than the exercise intervention.
It did. And it speaks to the power of systemic weight reduction. The sources show that greater reductions in BMI were consistently associated with larger decreases in HICP. And importantly, the effects held up more consistently across different levels of confounder adjustment than physical activity did.
So it was dose dependent.
Very much so. A 3% BMI reduction, for instance, corresponded to an 18.2% prevalence. So a moderate population-wide reduction in weight just has this really quantifiable and robust impact on high-impact chronic pain.
A 1.4 percentage point shift.
Yeah.
That number sounds small, but when you translate that to hundreds of thousands of people moving out of debilitating pain, that's a massive public health win.
It is the absolute definition of the Rose Principle in action.
Let's pivot to policy relevance. Did the researchers see any notable differences when they sliced the data, you know, by age, sex, or socioeconomic deprivation?
The results were actually pretty stable, which is good news for universal policy. So for sex, men started with a lower baseline HICP prevalence than women. It was about 16.3% versus 20.8%.
Okay.
But the absolute reduction from that 7% BMI drop was similar for both sexes. The policy is beneficial regardless of your starting point.
What about age?
Age showed a very clear differential benefit. The absolute benefit of that 7% BMI reduction was highest in the oldest group, those aged 60 to 70.
Oh, interesting.
For them, it reduced prevalence by 1.5 percentage points. Compare that to a 1.1 percentage point reduction in the 40 to 50 age group.
So as HICP prevalence goes up with age, Interventions targeting weight will deliver the biggest bang for your buck in an aging population.
That's right.
And what about socioeconomic deprivation? We know that's so highly correlated with chronic illness.
That was maybe the most surprising finding. While the interventions did show slightly greater effects for those with the highest deprivation, the difference in benefit between the most and least deprived groups was it was extremely small,
really?
Less than 0.2 percentage points, which is powerful evidence that these interventions are broadly effective across the entire socioeconomic spectrum.
Which brings us back to the real-world policy implications then.
Yes. Since HICP is driven by this cumulative effect of, well, biological, psychological, social, and environmental factors, right, achieving these population shifts requires systemic public health interventions.
Not just more health campaigns.
Not just telling people to try harder.
You can't just tell people to exercise more. You have to change their environment to make the healthy choice the easy choice.
Exactly. The sources are very clear on this. It means going beyond the doctor's office. We need subsidies for healthy, affordable foods. We need effective nutritional labeling, targeted taxes.
And urban planning.
And radical urban planning that actively prioritizes cycling and walking. Yes.
And tying that back to HICP specifically, urban planning that prioritizes active travel isn't just about general fitness. It's about making sure that the 50-year-old with a higher BMI and maybe some early-stage hip pain finds it less burdensome to get those extra steps in.
You're interrupting the cycle of pain leading to immobility, which leads to more pain.
Right.
And by implementing these big structural changes, you don't just reduce HICP, you get these massive, broader reductions in cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, certain cancers. It's an incredibly efficient use of policy capital.
So to sum it up, this research provides concrete, adjusted numbers. It supports the idea that these modest, achievable population shifts are quantitatively associated with really important reductions in HICP. It's solid justification for prioritizing prevention over purely clinical management.
But we have to mention the crucial caveat.
Of course.
The methodology is robust, but the population is the UK Biobank. And they are not fully representative of the general population. They are, on average, a bit healthier, a bit older, and less deprived.
Okay, so if the UK Biobank population is generally healthier, with lower baseline risk and higher activity levels, doesn't that raise a big red flag about applying these numbers to the general population?
It raises a flag, but one that actually points in a hopeful direction.
How so?
Because the biobank participants start healthier, the observed reductions in HICP that we've just been talking about are likely conservative.
Oh, I see.
A real-world population, which has a higher average BMI and lower activity levels, would likely see even larger absolute reductions from these same interventions.
So these numbers are probably the minimum expected benefit.
That's a great way to put it, yes.
This raises an important question. We know that lifestyle factors and chronic pain, they mutually influence one another. Pain makes you less active. That increases BMI, which then increases your risk further. If we can't solve this with simple linear thinking, where do we look next?
Well, the necessary shift is towards systemic models that can actually account for this reciprocal causality. We need policy that breaks that negative feedback loop and instead creates a virtuous cycle where structural change helps manage the pain, which then empowers the individual to be active and manage their weight. That leads to sustained equilibrium changes in population health. That is the necessary evolution for tackling this rising burden of chronic pain.